Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Douglas Cox. I represent the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities, or APSCU, in this appeal. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Congress gave the Department of Education limited authority with respect to each of the three regulations at issue, and these regulations were adopted in violation of those limits, and also in violation of the APA and of the Constitution. The regulations thus must be struck down as a matter of statutory construction. Very significantly, Your Honors, the day before the Department's brief was due in district court, the Department offered up a Dear Colleague letter. Now, the Dear Colleague letter does not cure the statutory failings I've referred to, and indeed, it contradicts the regulations and introduces new uncertainties into the regulatory regime. It seems that the DCL is, in fact, an implicit concession that the regulations as written do not pass legal muster. The case thus presents the court with a highly unusual situation where the department is trying to correct the regulations through something short of notice and comment rulemaking in the middle of litigation.
All the corrections are in your direction, though.
Well, Your Honor, that's not clear, actually, because a number of the corrections, it seems to me, don't withstand analysis. That is to say, the regulation says one thing, the DCL says something else, and it's not clear which is the actual rule. It's not clear which rule will be enforced by the courts. And of course, Your Honor, we operate in a world of key TAM litigation. It's not clear which version will be seized upon by the key TAM relators. Indeed, Your Honor, it seems to me the DCL is so flawed that a court facing the question, what am I going to apply, the regs as written or the DCL, is going to go with the regs as written. The DCL, for example, it seems to me, does not qualify for what the courts call our deference.
Well, if we were to give it our deference, wouldn't that protect you as from any ambiguity as to what's controlling in another litigation?
Well, no, Your Honor, because I don't think you can give it our deference.
I understand you have that argument, but
right.
But the right now you have, for instance, a passage in the regulation in which, as you argue, it says including circumstances 1, 2, and 3, when in fact their statutory authority is exhausted with 1, 2, and 3. The DCL concedes that point. Now, if we defer to that and say, well, that is in fact their authoritative considered position and interpretation of their own regulations, that would protect you, would it not, against someone proceeding on the basis of the overly broad regulation?
Your Honor, I don't believe it would. Even just focusing on that aspect, which is the misrepresentation regs, there are a number of things in the reg that we believe exceed the statutory authority. And by limiting themselves in that one way on that one issue, they don't solve all of the regulatory problems.
No, they address and perhaps solve the one. There's another one where they deal with commercial speech, right? Try to rein that in, I believe.
No, Your Honor, if we can go back and actually look at what it says in the regulation on this issue, it forbids a school from making a substantial misrepresentation regarding the institution. That's the substantive phrase. They then go on to say including. And so what the DCL says is, hey, we didn't really mean including. We meant just those three categories. But the reg still has separately the provision that says you make a misrepresentation regarding the institution, we can punish you for it. It's also the case, Your Honor.
I don't see how this is different than the prior example about which we just had an exchange. If they then limit it through the DCL, why isn't that pro tanto relief for
your Honor, because I think it's more than just the three categories. In other words, if they're trying to rewrite the regulation through the DCL, they haven't done an adequate job of it. And, Your Honor, it's also the case that in the regs, there is a fourth category, right? And so the fourth category of misrepresentations identified in the regs, and there's no suggestion in the DCL that they are even acknowledging its existence. So they haven't rewritten that part of the regulation. Your Honor, since we're already talking about misrepresentation, let me stay on that for a moment. The statute, as I say, bars a limited set of misrepresentations. We think the regs clearly go beyond it. The reg, wholly apart from the scope, also is expanded to include indirect statements to the public and statements that have a possibility of causing confusion. The department conceded in the rulemaking that they were broadening their misrepresentation regs, and I think that the fact that they have gone this far suggests that it's not limited to commercial speech. It is covers a substantial amount of political speech, and therefore, when you also take into account, Your Honor, that it's not content neutral, it seems to us that the department has to come forward and identify a compelling interest and show that they have a narrowly tailored way to address it. They haven't done that. They've said it's purely commercial speech, and we just don't think that you can get there given what the regs say. And, Your Honor, one of the commenters, in fact, pointed out that when you look at all the things the department has done with misrepresentation, the fact that it's not tailored, the use of tendency to confuse, getting rid of the safe harbor for minor statements, calling into doubt the availability of the procedures to protect your interests, that what the department is doing is creating a regime where it is better to stay silent than speak.
And what's our standard of review on this?
Your Honor, it's de novo.
No, I know it's to the summary judgment, but on the First Amendment claim.
Your Honor, I think that the standard here is the department doesn't contest that these regulations are not content neutral. And so therefore, the test established in Playboy Entertainment requires them to demonstrate that they're serving a compelling interest and that it's narrowly tailored to serve that interest. And Your Honor, they don't.
The argument, as I understood, they make is this is commercial speech, and that the hypotheticals you've come up with regarding non-commercial speech are precisely that, and therefore, consistent with our standard of review at this stage on a facial attack, we would go with their view, in other words, and wait for the situation to arise.
Well, Your Honor, two things. One is that the court has been clear that even when you have a facial case, if the regs violate the statute, they will be invalidated. The Lorillard case in the Supreme Court is a facial challenge to the regulation of speech. So I think that that's not a hurdle that the court needs to linger over. Secondly, Your Honor.
That's only if we agree it's inconsistent with the statute.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. That's right.
But I think what Judge Rogers is saying, if assume hypothetical, we don't agree it's inconsistent with the statute, and you have a facial overbreath challenge on your First Amendment, why would we take it at this point?
Your Honor, I think even if you were to agree it was consistent with the statute, you would still need to go through and look at our APA arguments for whether or not what they've done here is reasonable, whether or not they are pursuing a legitimate interest.
I want to clarify where we are on the First Amendment. I'm trying to get, there's so many things on this list here.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me that between Reno and the statements that the court has made with respect to overbreath arguments, that you certainly can't convince us, I don't think, that there's no possibility of these regs being read in a lawful way. So I don't know why we would apply it in a lawful way. I don't know why we would look at it at this point and not wait for whatever enforcement actions occur, consistent with both Reno and Judge Ginsburg's recent opinion saying that's the law in this circuit, and the court's overbreath. I realize the court will look. The Reno arguments and the overbreath arguments are sometimes inconsistent, but in any event, the court has said, reach a certain point, we're just not going to look at overbreath as really about enforcement.
Your Honor, if I may make 3 points in response.
Go ahead.
For starters, and again, not to continue to press the point, we think when you look at the regs, they are inconsistent with the statute.
I understand your argument there.
Secondly, my next point would be, Your Honor, that we believe that the regs on their face extend to a substantial amount of political speech, and that in that setting, all we need to do is demonstrate that there is substantial overbreath for the court to take a look at it. And indeed, in the recent case of Shirley versus Sebelius, when you go and you look at that case, is that the case I thought you were referring to?
That's one of them, yeah.
Yes. You see there what the court does is it does Chevron step one, is it consistent with the statute, and Chevron step two, And then it goes through all of the arguments under Chevron Step 2, you know, the APA arguments as well, and that's what we submit you must do here before, at the end, in a section called subsidiary arguments, the court says, well, you know, these regs might be able to be applied in inconsistent ways, but we're not going to reach that. Right. And what I think the proper way to understand, Shirley, is that what the court basically said was that we believe these regs do comport with the statute and do comport with the APA, and therefore we're not going to hear the imaginative construction.
Okay, well, then you're agreeing with what I'm suggesting.
Except that I think that we win on either of those two.
I hear you think you win on those, but I'm just trying to figure out.
Yes, you're right. Okay. The mode of analysis.
Okay. Well, what your argument is. All right.
Your Honor, let me step to the compensation provision of the regulations. The statute says the institution will not provide any commission, bonus, or other incentive payment based directly or indirectly on success in securing enrollments. The department has taken this and has rewritten the statute to ban any payments, any salary adjustments that are based on success in securing enrollments directly or indirectly. And indeed, Your Honors, they have gone very, very far indeed. They say that a salary adjustment is itself a bonus or commission. They say that you cannot demote people without running the risk of violating this provision. They say that you cannot have in your employment system any credit for recruiting students who go on to graduate, even though, again, the language of the statute focuses on success in securing enrollments. So it is just extraordinarily broad. And we believe that that is not what Congress meant in adopting this phrase. We think when you look at the legislative history, it's clear they were focusing on problems with commission salespersons. And indeed, Your Honor, it has come up in several other appellate courts that have looked at this and said, yes, the problem is commission salespeople, it's counting by the head, capitation payments, and it does not extend to all forms of salary adjustment. So we think, again, right there at the matter, the level of analyzing the statute, we prevail. Your Honor, if you look at the DCL dramatically mucks it up, tries to rewrite the regs in several ways, again, doesn't leave it clear what the right answer is. The DCL is even inconsistent with itself. And so I think you have to take the reg that's the product of notice and comment rulemaking on its own terms, and when you look at it.
Well, you got to go through this for us because several of them are captured by the Reno requirement. These are facial challenges. And separate out, where do you think you can win on the, you can survive on the facial challenge requirements? Which one of these? I mean, I'm looking at the list. Some of these are facial challenges. You're subject to Sebelius, Reno, et cetera, and it's a very high standard.
Your Honor, we understand it's a high standard.
Okay, so where do you think, where you're facing that standard, that you can win? That is, there's no possible lawful reading of the regulation.
Well, Your Honor, I think, as I said earlier, we don't think you get to the no possible until you answer the statutory question. In Rust, in construing when can you bring a facial challenge, it said you can prevail by showing the regulations are not, quote, authorized by the Act. Mm-hmm. And so for each of these three regs that we challenge, we have, we believe, very compelling arguments. They're not authorized by the Act. And if you agree with us, we win right there. Secondly, Your Honor, taking Shirley versus Sebelius as our model, we then believe, even if you disagree with us about the statute, you have to go through and say, is what the department did here consistent with notice and comment rulemaking? Have they just promulgated mush and tried to clear it up? Have they promulgated something that doesn't make any sense and tried to save it by putting in a waiver provision? The court has to protect notice and comment rulemaking, and it seems to us that what the department has done here clearly violates that. These regs are in effect. Our clients are paying money to comply with them and are at peril as a regulatory matter of the department coming in. And so I don't think, Your Honor, that this really is a case where the court should say, you know, we don't have enough in front of us. We're just going to wait and let the department take an enforcement action. And I submit further, Your Honor, that particularly when you think that we have here clearly regulations that intrude upon the First Amendment, saying we're going to wait, we're going to let people operate under a set of regs that chills their exercise of their First Amendment rights is not something that I think the court should tolerate. Let me just briefly touch on the last reg. I do want to save some time for rebuttal. The last reg we challenge has to do with state authorization. The department imposes two new requirements under state authorization. The district court thought we didn't have standing on this issue. When the department challenged our standing at the district court level, we put in an affidavit, so we did respond as this court instructs people to do. We think we clearly have standing because whether states comply with what the department has ordered them to do or not, we are hurt either way. With respect to the substance of the state regs, they are solely the product of the department's analysis of the situation. They're not authorized at all by the HEA, and they are burdensome, and the states may not comply. And the department acknowledges the states may not comply. And indeed, the University of Michigan put in a comment letter pointing out that the requirement that they be recognized by name is one that they cannot satisfy because they're recognized generically in their constitution because they predate the state entering the union. So, Your Honor, again, we think that these requirements fail under Rust at the first hurdle because they're not authorized by the Act.
All right,
I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Joshua Waldman. I'm from the Department of Justice, representing the Department of Education in this case. The Department of Education's new regulations address the conditions for schools who voluntarily choose to have their students have access to the billions of dollars in federal aid given every year. Given the ordinary rules of Chevron deference that apply here, the agency's reasonable basis for strengthening its rules, and the high hurdle for a plaintiff such as this one in a facial challenge to the regulations, the district court correctly rejected most of the plaintiff challenges. I'm happy to start with the compensation regulations in the order that the briefs, unless the court has any particular area that they'd like me to begin with. And not hearing anything?
If you have time to deal with everything, why don't we be selective?
Okay.
About the graduation rate, why is that a banned criterion?
Well, it's not a banned criterion. What the regulation does is it removes an old safe harbor that used to say if you base your bonuses, commissions, or incentive payments on graduation rates, we're not even going to look at it. It's per se categorically okay. And all the department is saying now is we've learned through our experience that that just becomes a giant loophole for giving exactly the kinds of bonuses that were intended to be prohibited. And so the only thing that's being said is you can't get a rubber stamp simply because you point to graduation rates. That's the only thing that's been done by this regulation with respect to graduation rates, and we think that's entirely permissible, and there's nothing in the statute that would require us, the department, to do otherwise.
The same with salary adjustments?
The same with salary adjustments. The regulation says you can do salary adjustments. The only thing, and it specifically says you can make merit-based adjustments. That's the title of the subsection. And the department has made clear that there's all kinds of salary adjustments that you could make that are not based on securing enrollments. Both the preamble to the final rule and the Dear Colleague letter repeated a number of instances, type of criteria that you could use that aren't based on enrollments. So salary adjustments are still permitted as long as they're not based on enrollments. And as the-
So for a recruiter, what are some lawful criteria?
Well, you could base it on student evaluations. You could base it on professionalism.
Evaluations of the student?
Students will evaluate the counselors or the recruiters to see, did they make a good match? Was I actually a good match? Did they give me good information? Were they helpful? The schools
can- That's fine for counselors, but what about just straight recruiters?
Well, that's what I'm saying about recruiters. Recruiters come in, they have to give information. Students can evaluate, did they, and so can the schools. Are the recruiters giving accurate information that's helpful to the students? Are they presenting it in a professional way? Are they dependable? Are they following whatever our rules are for how you interact with students? So there's all kinds of criteria. And as the department pointed out, the old safeguard, which existed from 2002 on, which, as I understand it, the plaintiffs don't really have any objection to that, used to say as long as you weren't solely based on enrollments, and schools all the time were allowed to then base it partly on enrollments, but then a whole host of criteria that were not based on enrollments. And the department's view is, well, if you could figure out what those were, the non-enrollment criteria were under the old safe harbor, you can certainly figure them out today. So all we're saying is some of the ones are not permissible, but everything else that was on the list that you've been identifying for a decade still remain. That was pointed out in the preamble, and it was pointed out again in the Dear Colleague letter. We think that the salary adjustment, the definition of commission, bonus, other incentive payment as a sum of money given for services rendered falls well within the statutory language, particularly given Chevron. It's a rational rule that was intended to tighten loopholes that made it too easy to evade.
Well, in that respect, what did the department say about extending the rule to managers and supervisors?
Well, what they said was that in the experience of the department, there were upper-level managers who could create a culture that pushed recruiters or counselors, if some people call them, to just enroll as many people as they could just to get financial aid. And so they recognized that management had a role in creating the problem, and that the statute, which speaks only about employees, doesn't make any sort of separation between the level of the employee, that upper level management could be subject to the rule. Again, the old safe harbor simply said if you were in upper management, we weren't going to touch you. And all the elimination of the safe harbor says is now you can be subject to the rule. It doesn't mean everyone is subject to the rule. It depends on are they engaging in certain activities, and are their bonuses, commissions, or incentive payments based on securing enrollments.
What was the empirical or other basis for saying organizational culture is implicated here?
Well, I think it was the experience of the department seeing a lot of abuses of the compensation regulations, and the feeling was that the regulations need to be tightened, that absolute safeguards that wall off whole people or areas were just loopholes leading to abuses. Now, there may be many cases in which management is not doing anything wrong. The regulations leave ample room for that. All the regulations are saying is we're not going to turn away from any particular area. Abuse, it's too easy to abuse the old safeguards, safe harbors, and so we're going to eliminate them, which is not to say that there's going to be a massive number of going after senior management, only that it's a possibility.
So the answer is there is some empirical evidence?
The answer is that there's empirical evidence of abuse,
right.
And the feeling is that
by managers.
But I don't know offhand whether it singles out managers. But I think the view is that culture often can drive these things. I think there's a reasonable assumption that it's coming from somewhere, and
it's a pretty evanescent notion, organizational culture, unless you have some.
Well,
something to back it up.
Well, it's also it's the culture, it's the upper management that often sets the incentive levels. Obviously, the employees don't set their own levels.
That's not organizational culture. That's flat-out violation of your incentive program or disincentive program.
Right, that's true. But sometimes, in addition to just sort of, well, sometimes they blend together, which is you create an organizational culture by the way that you set your compensation levels, but it also comes from other ways. And I don't think that the agency is necessarily held to an empirical study about what managers do and don't do. I think they can
Doesn't
make
the
supposition that it's coming
persons?
From somewhere. Excuse me?
Does the statute say any persons?
I believe it uses the word employees.
Any persons or entities engaged in any student recruiting, blah, blah, blah. No? Am I wrong?
Any persons or entities is the language.
Doesn't limit it to employees.
I'm sorry, no, you're correct. You're correct. The correct language is any persons or entities. And I think, as I think I pointed out before, Judge Edwards, it doesn't make any distinction in the language of the statute between management and lower level employees.
And they're not arguing the contrary, right? Right.
I don't understand
the debate. Does this organizational culture appear?
Let's see.
What, in the record?
In the, yes, in the
in
record.
The preamble.
220. 220, I think, in the appendix, if I have it right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have the I think you had the 220, but it's definitely in a statement in the preamble about driving the organizational culture, and that's one of the reasons behind getting rid of the old safe harbor.
220 was the suggestion?
I think.
No. Well, maybe at rebuttal you can point us to that. Well, you don't have rebuttal.
Do you concede their due process? You're essentially conceding their concerns on the due process on misrepresentation, right?
This is the four-category list. Uh-huh. What we're saying is that, as we said in the regulation itself, in the preamble to it, and as we repeated in the Dear Colleague letter, nothing in this regulation changes the previously existing procedural rights that existed under the old regulations. And our view is that every time the statute requires notice and hearing, so too do these new regulations.
So as I understand, your position now is revoke merely means revoke a provisionally certified institution's agreement.
That's correct.
So, and that's essentially a concession to the point that they're... I understand you'd rather frame it differently, but they're saying that's not what you initially wrote, and you're saying that's what we meant to write.
Yes, that's what we meant by it, yes. Revoke meant only provisionally certification. I always, sort of, I'll be candid, I hesitate at the word concession, but I think what we're essentially saying is we're all agreeing, I think, on what the regulation should mean. We say it does mean that. I think they say it does. It doesn't and can't mean that. Our view is we said in the preamble that it doesn't eliminate any previously existing procedural rights required by statute. And we said it again in the Dear Colleague letter, and we offer the reason how we interpret the rule here. Revoke only means revoke provisionally certified institutions. Those are not entitled to the same statutory notice and hearing rights as the fully certified ones.
In the DCL, pardon me, is in at least some respects, or let's say one respect to take an example, literally inconsistent with the regulation, correct? It's not just a clarification. It changes it from, let's say, including 1, 2, and 3 to limited to 1, 2, and 3.
I think that might be fair to say, although I would say it does literally include those categories. There could be a way of reading that, and maybe it's the most natural way to suggest that it goes beyond it, but we don't think you have to read it that way. So I wouldn't say that it's literally inconsistent.
The statute enumerates three situations, mm-hmm. and you say the reg says this applies to those three situations, to various situations, including those three, and then the DCL comes and says we met only those three.
Right.
That's the substance of it, right?
Yes, I think that's the gist of it, yes.
So I don't see how, without deference to the DCL, the reg can withstand comparison with the statute in that regard.
I would say two things. First, I would say I think you should defer to the DCL. I don't think there's any reason not to.
Well, let me give you, well, go on to your second point. We'll come back to
the second point is that is only a very small one, which is to say I think there's a way to read it so they're not literally inconsistent.
That should be the first point then.
Okay. I'll flip the order. Our first point is that it's not literally inconsistent, and the second point would be, I think,
okay,
that
you
should...
Okay, but how is it not... I mean, one says including, which clearly implies that there's more than three, and the other says, no, that we really just meant three.
Because it's only an implication. I don't think you have to necessarily read it as saying we are asserting an authority to go beyond the statute. It's only by implication, and that's why...
I don't understand. Why isn't your answer to this and the due process, whatever, look, we think... You ought to give us our deference on these things, and if not, send it back and we'll fix the reg. I mean, why are you quibbling over this? This is silly. Obviously, it's wrong, and I realize as an attorney, our instinct is, well, we got to kind of make it sound right. It's wrong. And why don't you just say it's wrong? We think we fixed it in the Dear Colleague letter. And if you don't think so, send it back and we'll fix it in the rec.
Well, I thought I was making your first point about we think we fixed it in the Dear Colleague letter. Right. I thought that was my second point.
And then Judge Ginsburg may say our may not work, and then your answer should be, well, then send it back.
Well, first you can say it does work.
Yeah. I think if we lost on all our arguments, you wouldn't have any problem saying the last point.
Right, let's think of a reason or talk about a reason why it might be a poor idea for our deference here. Looking at some of the criteria in our itself, mm-hmm. consider judgment, mm-hmm. some level of formality, mm-hmm. seems to meet those criteria. But it follows here immediately upon the following of the filing of the brief challenging the regulation. So the regulation looks like a sucker punch. Mm-hmm. Right, we put out this broad thing, anybody challenges it, we'll immediately pull in our horns, no problem. Mm-hmm. We'll get deference for that, and they can go whistle in the dark. Now that's one reason to suggest that's not consistent with the court's reason for recognizing, giving deference in our itself. Second, this is an obscure document. It may have been well considered. It may be the considered position of the agency. It's not in the CFR. It's not been circulated to any relevant public except regional directors or some other subsidiary elements within the agency. Right? And so a party seeking to comply with the regulations is going to look at CFR, and it'll be mere chance if they happen to know about the limiting interpretation here, unlike a brief perhaps or some other documents. Okay.
I just want to make sure you're done with your question before I just – I'll take the first point first, which is there's some notion, as you suggested, that this was all sort of drummed up solely in response to litigation and just sort of sandbag the
letter went out the day after the filing, right?
Yes. Now, this Dear Colleague letter was in the works almost from day one.
Well, it has to have been long in the works to be released a day after the filing.
Right. And the department was receiving many comments and questions about what exactly the regulation meant, requests for clarification that had been collecting almost from the publication. And had been preparing a Dear Colleague letter, before this litigation, before it was filed in this litigation. And if you actually look at it, the first half of it responds to a whole bunch of questions that don't have anything to do with this case.
Sure. And there may be other responses to questions that are on the cutting room floor because they weren't raised in the brief.
As a matter of fact, it
surely looks as though clearly part of it, as you say, is responding to questions not related to this litigation.
Right. Now,
and other parts of it are very clearly or directly responsible.
That's true. And we actually thought it would be helpful to the district court to have this out before before it was trying to draft its opinion and had an argument rather than after.
Well,
and
the district court shared your view.
Yeah. And in fact, my understanding is I think there have been six Dear Colleague letters about this regulation since that to clarify other points. So we produced these documents. We produced them on other regulations as well. I believe they're up on the website. So it's not as if nobody has them. So, I think we're just sort of trying to make a bona fide clarification. And as I think we point out in the brief too, many of the things that we say, many of them in response to the points they raise in this litigation, simply cite or in some instances directly quote the preamble. And so there was a little bit of a surprise of, well, you didn't understand that we weren't changing procedural rights? Well, we said that in the preamble. We'll say it again now. And so to say that sort of like, they may be surprised by it, but we had already said that in the Federal Register notice. So we don't think that we're saying anything different in many instances.
What's the answer to the hour question?
I think the hour question is because of all these circumstances don't give you any reason to doubt that this is the agency's considered position, that it's entitled to our deference.
It looks that way. It also looks like a formula for departments and agencies to induce or to take a chance that they won't be challenged in some respects and then pull in their horns on others and manipulate the process without doing it in the rulemaking.
Well, we certainly try to be as clear as we can in a rulemaking, but if something is this complex, people are going to ask questions, especially when things change after a while. And the department is doing its best to respond to these questions in an orderly and clear fashion.
I do understand that in part, but where you use words in the regulation, aren't you bound by those words at least?
I think to the extent that they can't be interpreted some other way, but we think in all instances, if you have a particular example in mind, I think that a lot of the things that they complain about certainly can be interpreted precisely in the way that we talk about in the Dear Colleague letter, but without knowing exactly which example you're thinking.
Well, we've been focusing on the words or, and we've been focusing on the word including.
Well, it's certainly, with respect to or, this wouldn't be the first time that a court said construed or really to mean and.
I know.
And Unification Church is a case, De Silva versus Ballantyne is another. So I think as long as it's not outside the bounds of how you can interpret it, then I think that you ought to defer to the Dear Colleague letters you would in any other case where an agency was interpreting its own regulation. And with respect, same thing with respect to including, I think there's an implication, and it's not an unreasonable implication, but it's not the only way to read the regulation. And if the agency is coming in and saying, this is how we understand what the limits are, we understand them consistent with the statute, that's essentially what they're asking for. We're on a facial challenge where the agency has never asserted a right to go beyond the categories. I think in that context, you ought to defer to the letter. And if there's some future case and in an as-applied fashion where a school thinks that you're going beyond the statute, they can bring. They certainly are free to bring that case.
Should we go on beyond?
Yes,
to go, we want to take us back for just a moment.
Sure.
To the organizational culture.
Yes.
I'm advised that that concept appears in the notice of proposed rulemaking, but nowhere in the final rule.
That the about driving the organizational culture.
Right.
That may be so, but it's the agency's rationale. Regardless, and it was certainly publicly stated. And there's, I think there's been a question about whether we have statutory authority to go beyond it. But I don't know if there's any dispute that we said that driving the culture was part of our rationale.
Then on another small but an unrelated topic,
sure.
the National Association of College Admissions Counselors and DeVry, both, I believe, were concerned that the rules with respect to, or the new rule with respect to graduation, I think it was, as a criterion, would be, it was part of the recruiting rule in any event, would have an untoward effect on minority recruitment. And I guess it's in your brief in which you said the answer to that was it applies to all, quoting, it applies to all recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
That is a statement that is there. It's in the final rule document. But it is not offered in response to those comments. And there's no suggestion that it anywhere in the document other than the brief that it was directed to those comments or is responsive to those comments. Somewhere along the line, the agency had said in the rulemaking document, this applies to all recruitment. Okay? Then you get a question, well, what about minority recruitment? Well, we just said this applies to all recruitment, but you weren't thinking about, you didn't have that question before you or identified in the rulemaking in the response to comments when you made that statement, when the agency made that statement. So I don't know that there's any evidence that the agency actually considered that issue that was raised by NACAC.
Well, I'm not sure which part of the record you're talking about, but my recollection is and what I think was cited in their reply brief was page 357 of the joint
357.
Appendix. And we can sort of just take a look at that. And I'll flip to it,
too. I think that's right.
Is that the one you're talking about?
That sounds awfully familiar.
This is the Career Education Corporation. I don't know if that's the one you're...
paragraph 11, I think.
Yeah, and they asked... How will the new regulations apply to employees who are not involved in general recruiting, but who are involved in recruiting certain types of students? And then they go on to talk about those who recruit only minority students. And so as I understand it, this is a question directed at, are certain types of recruiters different from other types of recruiters? And the agency answered, no, it applies to all.
All right, show me where they answered that. I think they said that, but I don't think it's an answer to this concern.
Okay. This would be at A44 to 45.
Well,
A44 would be that. There's a whole question here, one of which they actually phrase it here as a president who was involved in minority enrollment, but I think it's still the same point, which is if it's one person doing sort of a specialty kind of recruiting, how does it apply? And the agency's answer, this is the third column,
yes,
on A44, says, we intend the incentive compensation ban in 668.14 to apply to all employees at an institution
who are engaged in any student recruitment or admission activity,
right,
et cetera. Now, and then you say, we interpret these employees to include any higher level employee with responsibility. That seems to be what you're addressing. This is under a heading discussion preceded by comments,
mm-hmm, right,
to which you're responding.
Yes.
And the comments are not the comments about minority recruitment.
Sure it is.
Where? I missed it then. Where?
It's at the very end of the discussion. The paragraph begins.
No, that's the discussion. The discussion's answering the comments, and it wasn't answering this comment.
I must be confused. Above discussion.
Yeah.
Above discussion, there's a paragraph that says, finally, a few commenters. And two lines above that is, you see the words minority enrollment?
Two lines above that?
Two lines above. There's a paragraph that,
yes,
begins, finally, and then above that is minority.
I do, but I had not before.
Okay.
So give me a second, see if that's
this is why you took senior status.
Well, that's an answer to the following. A few commenters raised more specific concerns about compensation of top college officials, about minority recruiters, all right? Some commenters also asked whether proposed regs would permit a president to receive a bonus.
Or other payment, if one factor in attaining the bonus or other payment was meeting an institutional management plan or goal that included increasing minority enrollment.
This is all in this, I think, in the context of talking about eliminating the safe harbor. That's what it seems to be the topic, eliminating the safe harbor for managerial and supervisory employees, of whom the president is clearly one.
Yes, but it's asking it specifically in the context of minority enrollment. I think they might be if you look at the comment, if you go back, there's a bunch of comments here that they sort of, I don't know why they did this, but they sort of smush into one. And there's also in there questions about, specifically just about the college president, questions about athletic directors. So they are combining a bunch of topics.
Or conflating, perhaps. I mean, it makes it hard to say whether they've actually looked at the or responded to the comments that are issue here.
There was a specific question about institutional recruiting just for minorities. There was a comment and asking whether certain people are exempt from general recruiters. There's an answer that it applies to all of them. And I think that this is sort of fairly read to say that the department noted the comment, addressed the comment in its preamble, and answered the question. And then did so again, I believe, in the Dear Colleague letter.
You may be right about the Dear Colleague letter. The 359 is the other question on this topic from DeVry. The penultimate bullet point, can schools increase compensation to personnel involved in diversity outreach programs for successfully assembling a diverse student body? And the answer seems to be, you cannot compensate the president, or you can I don't remember what it was, but it dealt with the president.
The answer is that the compensation ban applies to all employees, and that I think that the fairly construing that answer is, it doesn't matter if you say the only kind of recruiting I do is minority recruiting, we're not making a categorical exception for that. You still come under the ban. Now, these people can obviously be paid as long as they're not given bonuses, commissions, or incentive payments based on securing enrollments. We do have a cross appeal. If I can have a few minutes to just address that, if anyone has any other questions, I'll answer those first.
Is this on operating?
Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to.
Yes,
know what you have to say about that.
Yes. It's our view that the old rule that used to exist or that governed before required legal authorization in any state where the institution is, quote, physically located, and that the proposed rule stated a different standard, one in which you needed to be licensed in any state where you operate, and that it's the, first of all, the contrast between the old rule physically located with the new statement about operating, combined with a successive discussion of reciprocity agreements, which have particular salience in this area of distance and correspondence education, an issue that had been discussed.
But not exclusively.
Not exclusively. But we don't think that in order to meet the standard that a interested party should have anticipated that a change is possible, that it has to be narrowly tailored only to one issue.
I understand that, but I mean, there are reciprocity agreements for all sorts of things.
Well, they would certainly have application beyond distance and correspondence education to some brick and mortar who had more than one, but I don't think anyone disputes, and I don't think plaintiff disputes, that they also have salience for this issue. And it's our view that the fact that those were discussed, the fact that there's such a clear contrast between the existing rule and the new operate standard, and confirmed by the fact that commenters understood it in precisely that way.
I thought comments showed they were confused.
No, I think comments showed people going both ways. Some people saying,
yes,
how can you make us go to all these states? And others saying, no, it's too lenient because with reciprocity, you sort of get around. So some people thought that the agency had gone too far. Some thought they hadn't gone far enough, but they all understood what the proposal on the table was. And we think that's more than sufficient to give notice to interested parties that a change was being contemplated by the department. And
so
therefore
it really boils down to this change from physically located to operated.
Yes, although I would just add that the discussion of reciprocity around that issue
significantly. Now, the only reason I keep pressing you on that
yes. Is
because the notice of proposed rulemaking tied it to other provisions, not what we're talking about now. So that's why I say that the real point is the change, what you call the clear contrast in language, sufficient?
I think that it would be sufficient, but I think it's helped by the reciprocity.
So the question of do you have operations in Arizona should be yes if you have a student registered there who resides there?
I'm sorry, could you...
The question put to a regulated firm, mm-hmm. Do you have operations in Arizona, should be answered yes, we do, if they have a student who's from Arizona, who resides in Arizona, enrolled in their program through the internet.
Yes.
And if the student moves to New Mexico?
You mean then you would have operations where that student is, so if they were enrolled in the distance learning
program. So they have to require the student to keep them abreast of their whereabouts?
Well, I think that students normally do keep them abreast of their whereabouts, particularly if they're paying tuition. The schools want to know where they are.
Really? I thought they just wanted to know if they had a PayPal account. I don't know. You're reinventing geography here. I thought we'd gotten away from all that.
Well, I mean, part of the reason why reciprocity, some people were proponents of that, is you might not necessarily have to sort of get new registration in New Mexico if New Mexico and the other state had, and whatever state the school was physically located in had reciprocity. So reciprocity agreements may make...
Reciprocity with where? With Arizona, where the student was before?
No, I think with whatever state the distance learning education was located in.
Oh, physically located?
Physically located. Okay. That's my understanding.
So it's physically located in Rhode Island, right? It's got a student in New Mexico
mm-hmm.
who moved to Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And... now it's located for new purposes. It's been located in all three states.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was not obvious from the reading of the proposal.
Well, I don't think there's no requirement in the logical outgrowth that the only requirement is that it give fair notice that a change is being contemplated. Now,
the change which is later made was being contemplated, right?
Yes.
Or something of that general nature, pretty
yes.
close to that.
Now, going from a physically located to an operate, now I grant you that where you operate might mean different things in different contexts, but it's giving a notice that the old rule, which was only physically located, is now being changed to something, or at least contemplated being changed to something about operate. And if you want to get your comments in, get your comments.
Some of the regulated firms have operations in multiple physical operations in multiple states, right? Mm-hmm. So under the old regulation, were they required to qualify in each state where they had brick and mortar?
I think wherever you're physically located, you
need
to get...
So that didn't mean one state. It's not like your corporate headquarters or something. It meant all
of them? I'm not positive whether or not the under the old rule, there was sort of considered a central place and that satellite offices did or didn't need. I don't know the answer to that. I apologize. I should, but I don't.
Thank you.
If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise...
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I can make a few quick points, Your Honors. For starters, I really do not think the DCL is a good candidate for our deference, not only because of the fact that it is inconsistent with the regs, but also because, unlike, for example, in Chase Bank, they introduced it into the course of the litigation. It clearly seems to me to be the kind of hasty thing that the court has to guard against. Your Honor, you mentioned that
it's an extensive document.
It is extensive, but...
It wasn't prepared between your filing day and the next day.
Well, no, Your Honor, just to correct that, we filed the complaint. They filed the DCL the day before their opposition to our motion for summary judgment was due. So they had...
They did have some time,
and I think, Your Honor, you know, you mentioned, well, it's inconsistent in this one instance. I just want to be clear, if there is any confusion, it is not inconsistent in only that one instance. And indeed, when you talk about the compensation provision, it is wildly inconsistent with what's in the reg.
In what sense is this a hastily prepared document? As you say, they had some months.
All right. My sense of it is, Your Honor, is that the department is faced with a litigation in which it is a party. So therefore, we're not in the Chase Bank world. It introduces it in the litigation to serve its own interests. The regs have not yet come into effect. You know, one of the comments my colleague said, well, things have changed. Things haven't changed. It is clearly a device, as you say, it's a sucker punch on notice and comment rulemaking. So I think those are significant indicators that in this case, this is a peculiarly rushed and litigation-tainted document. Your Honor, as I said, you mentioned that it was inconsistent in one area. We want to make sure the court is clear. It's also inconsistent when you speak about the compensation provisions. The department takes the position that, well, you can still have merit-based salary adjustments. That's meaningless, really, because they say everything is merit-based, directly or indirectly. Everything is merit-based. They say, even though a recruiter's job is to recruit, and they said that in the NPRM, they still say, you know, things like whether or not the student graduates is related to enrollment, because that's a statutory term, enrollment. Well, why is it related to enrollment? Well, you have to enroll before you can graduate. That's what they're saying to the regulated community. So the regulated community can't have confidence that they can actually have any mechanism for rewarding recruiters for their...
The record shows, I believe, that virtually everyone who enrolls is graduated.
Well, Your Honor, that, in fact, is not their concern behind...
I understand that they have not made that point. It seems to me that would have been highly relevant to say, well, graduation is nothing more than a close to perfect proxy for enrollment.
But, Your Honor, their point, in fact, is just the opposite. It's that, you know, too many people are enrolling who shouldn't be enrolled, and therefore...
But who are being graduated nonetheless, they say.
Well, or flunking out and then not paying back on their loans, right? So they want to tighten up on these provisions because they think that some schools in the field are recruiting unqualified students. And so they can't, it seems to me, combine that with saying, gee, too many people are graduating. But, Your Honor, that just goes to show they've taken a...
Well, now, wait a minute. Unqualified doesn't here mean unqualified for graduation. It also means unqualified for employment.
Well, Your Honor, this regulation is tied to success in securing enrollments, because that's the statutory term. There's a separate regulation that has to do with whether or not you get employment that's not challenged in this case.
I guess the and the excerpt that appears in the government's brief on this subject, I should have raised it with counsel but didn't, is kind of mixed on that, or maybe even mixed up. Let's see what page is that. Well, go on. I'll catch up with you, perhaps.
All right, Your Honor. So, as I say, we have the fact that they've gone beyond the statute by the reading of enrollments to include things like graduation and demotions. This is completely inconsistent with saying the recruiter's job is to recruit. Again, you touched on, Your Honor, the fact that the statutory term is whether or not you are engaged in recruiting. And they have taken that in the reg and changed it to be responsible for recruiting. And so that's obviously a much broader category, again, inconsistent with the statute. Your Honor, in addition to the questions you raised about minority enrollment, I'll also point out that in the record there's a report from a PhD economist, Dr. Slotsky from FTI, where he also makes the point that these compensation regulations will have negative impacts on minority recruitment. With respect to the cross appeal, just very quickly, Your Honor, you know, the page of the NPRM to which the department cites has a column in which it quotes twice from the statute where the language is about being in a state or within a state. And then under reasons simply says the HEA requires institutions to have approval from the states where they operate. That's the one sentence they hang on. And they're at least two things wrong with that. One, Your Honor, is the point you raised. It's not just moving around, are we going to get paid for our tuition? It's when they move around, we then are subject to a new state's regulatory regime. And the fact that this sentence on which they rely ties it back to the HEA, to the statute itself, which hasn't changed, was not a signal to the regulated community that they were dramatically changing the scope of this and were purporting to regulate people's offerings over the internet. And indeed, as you'll see from the record, ACE, which is another organization representing a large number of schools, has written in to say the state authorization regs and TOTO and this provision in particular should be repealed.
Is the internet the key part of this? Is that why the you say you're taken by surprise?
The internet is a key part of the school's operation. And the point is simply that nothing that the department said was a clear signal of that, and they failed the logical outgrowth test, as, again, you've already developed.
But it's in large part because of the internet operation.
That's right.
If you will, that you're caught by this.
Seemingly
off guard.
That's right.
Do you know the answer to Judge Ginsburg's question to counsel for the government in terms of if a school was physically located in more than one state, did they have to conform?
Your Honor, I believe that because the statute says you have to be registered within the state where you are found, that they did register.
That's in the old reg.
That's in the statute.
Oh, it's in the statute. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No further questions. Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.